I'm kind of embarrassed to ask this, but how do you say Yui Ball? Is it Yui Ball, or is it like
You know, I've heard Yui. We always called him Uwe.
Uwe.
That would be more in line with the Swedish or German.
Exactly, because the W is usually pronounced as
a V.
Yeah.
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 Hello and welcome to Simply Radio. Today's guest is Neil Every, and he is a screenwriter who started from an internship with the electrical department. And so he should have an interesting look, as far as we screenwriters go, into the industry. And I'll leave you with him to give himself an introduction. He's written a script. You might have seen the movie. You might not have seen the movie. Go ahead, Neil.
I started out wanting to be a novelist, and very quickly realized that I just wasn't cut out for that. And around the same time, I was a bit of a geek. I was into, you know, a lot of TV and stuff, and started gravitating towards the film and TV side, and eventually traveled halfway around the world to attend the Vancouver Film School. And then I got out of there in one piece, still wanting to do what I wanted to do, and worked in the camera department. It was camera, not electrical, mostly on US TV series like X-Files and Outer Limits and things like that. And then while I was doing that, I started working on my own projects, did a few short films along the way, and had my first breakthrough story consulting. I used to read a lot of my friends' scripts, and they said, "You're kind of good at this. You should do more. And did you know that you can actually get paid to do this?" And it was through the story consulting that I got my first produced feature script job. And then a couple of other things led on from that. And then I found myself working with a writing partner and working with Uwe Boll, the infamous Uwe Boll. And it was a really interesting experience. And I still don't really know if it's helped or hindered me having it on my resume, but yeah. And just sort of continuing on from there, I've got the last script produced, just premiered in China. It's a feature animated film, and it'll be probably going straight to DVD in North America. That's where we're at.
I saw that on IMDb. I was curious to see it. It looked kind of fun. And I'm definitely interested in hearing more about the Uwe Boll experience. And I didn't mention that Don and Pia are our panel for this evening. And so if they want to say hello, go for it.
Hola.
¿Qué pasa? ¿Cómo está?
I think they think tonight is the Spanish episode.
Oh, I'm sorry. Wrong language. I'm sorry.
Hey.
This is Guillermo Tormo. You know, I thought this was all about Pan's Labyrinth. I'm sorry. Okay.
So,
this is like an international co-production we've got going on here.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, yeah. Definitely international. And anyway, so let's tell us more about the Uwe Boll stuff up front. And I think that's probably a good place to start. And we can continue on from there.
Yeah, I was working with a writing partner at the time by the name of Christopher Donaldson. We'd known each other for years. We were roommates at the time. And we had a friend of ours was working at a local production company called Bright Light Pictures, which is based in Vancouver. And we found out that, you know, they were doing another Blood Rain movie, and we managed to get ourselves in the door to pitch for it, because we'd heard that they were doing a vampire western, and we just thought that would be a ton of fun to do. So we went in there with I think it was like a 5-page outline, I suppose. I think we did three different, completely different stories. Each was maybe a page and a half, and Uwe liked things in all of them, and so we took basically culled the best ideas from all of them. and off we went. It was really that simple. It's probably the easiest job I've ever gotten.
Really?
And it was crazy because from that meeting to them rolling camera was about 3 months. So it was almost an unheard of experience.
But in let's jump in. And one thing I really don't want to make I want to make this about you. I don't want this to be about. And I've been pronouncing his name incorrectly the whole time. It's pronounced Yuva Bowl.
Yuva Doctor. You know.
Yuva Uva.
He does have a doctorate. But,
well, cool. I got a master's, and I still can't sell a script. But anyway, 3 months. So in other words, you came in when you came in, you pitched, and then in 3 months they started production.
Yep.
Wow. When you came in to do the pitch, I mean, how firm was your story and your script? The question I'm asking is that. You know, where were you at minus 3 months as far as the story and the script, and then what were you doing in those 3 months until production started?
So we came out of that meeting with basically, I guess, a 5-page outline, which they signed off on, and that was the point at which, you know, contracts were drafted up and stuff, and everyone, you know, the lines were drawn in the sand as to what we were doing, how long we had to do the first draft, and at that point we didn't even know for sure when they were going to camera. We knew that it was going to be very soon, and they wanted the script as soon as possible. Wow. We knew that they pre-sold the movie at Cannes. So before even rolling a foot of film, they were already in the black as far as the dollars went.
Wow. I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's in my mind, I'm hearing this is even really before there was a solid story.
The outline had a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. Basically pitched it as being vampires have taken over this town, headed by Billy the Kid. Billy the Kid is the head vampire. And he's holding this gunfighting contest and basically holding this town to ransom. And Blood Rain comes in and saves the day, or tries to, gets her ass kicked, and is forced to leave the town. And she realizes that she can't do it on her own. And she hooks up with Pat Garrett, and they basically form a posse of crazy, over-the-top characters, and then come back to defeat the vampires. That was the original story, and at that point, Kristanna Loken was still going to be playing the lead character, Rain.
Oh, really?
And then we wrote the first draft, and then we found out that she was no longer available, and they were recasting the role, which I guess didn't really change things that much. There were some things that Kristanna had spoken to us about that she wanted to see, and we mm-hmm. tried to incorporate some of those things, and can't even remember if any of those things actually survived.
Wow. That's actually an interesting question, because I'm kind of curious how you felt the movie. Did it stick to your original script, or did it change a real lot?
No. In terms of what we wrote and what ended up on screen in the version that's on DVD, there's maybe 2 minutes of screen time that is as we wrote it.
Seriously? Wow.
2 continuous minutes.
Wow.
Like, it's a very odd experience for me watching it now. I try not to watch it, actually. It's, you know, they'll be like, okay, yeah, I remember that character, and that the scene where those two characters met didn't actually take place in that location, and that line of dialogue that character said was actually from this other scene and was actually given to another character. And just, it's a real mishmash.
I'm so glad you said that, because what I wanted to say was I actually saw Blood Rain Deliverance, but I was totally mesmerized by Natasha Malthy's boobs the entire time. So I really don't remember the story all that well. But get it, you know, one of these things that you hear, and I really like to hear from you about this, is that, you know, obviously, you know, the script is written, and then, you know, stars sign on, or actors and actresses sign mm-hmm. on, and they want changes, you know, because they don't feel their character would do or say this. So my question, and in two parts, is, you know, you said that there was, what, you know, 2 contiguous minutes of the script that you had actually written. and then things being reassigned. And the question I have is that, one, how do you work with the input from the actors and the actresses on the changes to the script? And two, when it comes down to final shooting script and those changes, are you a part of that process, or is it the director who's the one who is changing the dialogue among the actors?
Well, I mean, with this one, we turned in our first draft. They were really, really happy with it. We got some notes. The notes pretty much wanted us to cut all the scenes that advanced the main character. So that was a little challenging, but you know, it's like we were hired to do a job, so. You know, we did what we were told and tried to like still give the character an arc. It was drastically cut back. Like there are a number of scenes that I found that both myself and my writing partner felt really grounded the main character emotionally, and it was really sad cutting that stuff. But we were still able to hang on to enough stuff where the character did still arc. And then there was a lot of stuff that was cut basically for budget. The saddest loss there was our posse. Like originally when the character went off and recruited her posse to help her defeat the vampires, I think it was five people. So with her and Pat Garrett, it ended up being seven characters come the third act.
Wow.
And that ended up getting cut down to basically, I think it was two characters that they ended up recruiting.
Hmm.
So it wasn't a posse. Like, it was ridiculous. So we actually, we wrote a line, and I believe it survived the cut. I can't remember. But one of the vampires, when the so-called posse rides into town, one of the vampires says, "What kind of a posse is that?"
Because
it's like, it's like four people on a horse.
Well, that's great, though. That was
a budgetary thing. And then there were additional rewrites that were requested, and then, you know, time, dollars, various things came to a crunch. And they brought in, Uwe brought in another writer who did another rewrite and changed a lot of things, and a lot of the that's where all those switches with the dialogue and the plotting got switched around. Part of it was Uwe, part of it was the other writer that came in, part of it was probably the producers, you know, budget things. We weren't really involved in pre-production. We did three drafts, and then the next thing we knew was, you know, we did get to visit the set twice, and you know, we saw them doing some of the shooting, and it was, you know, just from visiting the set, we could tell that there was weirdness going on, that there was a lot of cuts and changes had been made. Natasha actually was really, really, she really liked the script that we turned in, and she was like, "Oh, I'm really sad they cut a lot of stuff," and you know, she was struggling with the script that they had to shoot with, but. You know, just get in the can.
Well, that's great. I'm glad you and Natasha got along.
She's fantastic. Dreamy. Yeah,
she's dreamy. The question: why did they invite you to the set? I mean, did they invite you to the set because they needed you to change Glad to Happy, or was it just kind of a courtesy thing?
Well, we had a relationship with some of the producers that at Brightlight, who were basically the service production company for the film. And
so you got invited by the service.
We asked them. We said, "Can we come and visit the set? Because we think it's really awesome that something we wrote is actually getting filmed." And they said yes. And yeah, we showed up there. And yeah, it was a strange experience. I mean, I used to work on sets. So it's very hard for me to go onto any set and not see crew people that I know. So
yeah,
you know, I know that I'm not supposed to stand in front of lights and all those kind of things. I'm very comfortable on a set, so you know, I just try to stay out of the way. And
most of our listeners, they see, you know, they are some of them are filmmakers, but most of them, I think, are screenwriters.
Yeah.
Okay, and it seems to be the dream is like writing for Hollywood, you know, but the realistic turn, you know, other end of it is independent film. But how about Canada? How about looking for screenwriters to look at Canada instead of Hollywood? I mean, it seems to me that Canada is kind of emerging as a pro film country.
Yes and no. I mean, Canada is definitely its own thing. I definitely have my opinions as to how the film industry works here. I mean, the service industry is huge here. They have a lot of tax incentives. A lot of the big budget Hollywood films get shot here, like Tron was shot in Vancouver, for example. A lot of TV series Fringe is shot in Vancouver. And then there is quite a large independent community as well. And a lot of that community is, I would say probably 90% of those films, if not more, is funded through government money. It's funded by Telefilm Canada. So it's basically, you know, tax dollars, which is funding the Canadian film industry. And I have a kind of mixed opinions about that. I think a lot of the films that get made are films that are never going to be able to compete in the marketplace in any way, shape, or form. They are very independent. The subject matter is not commercial in any way. There's definitely problems with the distribution side. Like, these films can't compete in the marketplace. And to get the Telefilm money to finance them, they have to have a distributor signed on. But the distributor only has to screen the film for 1 week in one Canadian theater in order to complete their requirement for the grant. So that doesn't really help the filmmaker. I mean, they throw a film into the theater for a week, fulfill their commitment. They maybe spend, you know, a couple of grand on the P&A campaign, you know, like the Vancouver Sun and the main newspaper in Toronto will get maybe a half page ad, and that'll be that. And then the film will be forgotten. You know, occasionally a film will get a little more attention on the festival circuit, but it's hard. It's hard getting a film made in Canada. It's just as hard getting a film made here as it is anywhere else, I would argue. It's at the end of the day, it's telling a good story and getting the right people on board to realize that story.
I heard a term in there that I was just curious about, just before you asked your question, Pia. You mentioned P&A campaign, and I just wasn't sure what that meant.
That's your print and advertising.
Ah, okay.
I mean, your average studio film,
yeah,
their P&A campaign would be, you know, upwards of 30 to 40 million just for the promotion and advertising costs. Mm. So, and in Canada, it's absolutely minuscule. I mean, there basically isn't. It's not even really budgeted to promote the film. Like, the hope is that it'll get noticed on the festival circuit and get picked up by a good distributor. But unless you're Adam McGoyan or David Cronenberg, majority of people that doesn't really happen to. There are new filmmakers coming up through the ranks in Canada that I think have a more commercial viewpoint. People like Troy Nixie, who Guillermo del Toro executive produced his first feature. That's coming out soon. Hmm. People like Michael Dowes, who did It's All Gone, Pete Tong, and Fubar. What's his name who did it? Neil Blomkamp. He's from South Africa, but he spent his formative years as a filmmaker in Vancouver. A lot of his crew who worked on District 9, they're all from Vancouver.
Hmm.
But it's sad that he had to go elsewhere to make District 9. Like, he couldn't make that as a Canadian film. But the system just isn't in place for that kind of film.
Okay, I had another question then. You have done a lot of camera work on a lot of different projects, and how has that helped you or hindered you, whichever the case may be, as far as a screenwriter?
As far as a screenwriter, I think it's really helped me in the rewrite process, particularly in terms of if I get notes back on a script saying, you know, this one sequence puts us at 5 million and we have to get it down to 3 million in terms of the budget. It doesn't scare me. Like, I know I can find solutions. So just being on set, it really helps you realize the reality of film production. Like, you know, and this has helped me in terms of the directing side of things too. I mean, I've seen first time writers on set as directors, and they'll make something that seems like a really simple request, like, let's convert the Steadicam from regular mode to low mode so that we can do a really low angle shot sweeping along the floor. And that seems like something that would be pretty easy to do. Depending on the camera system that you're using, that can be a 20 to 30 minute process, because the whole rig has to be rebuilt and rebalanced. And, you know, steady cams are very particular, filmmaking tools, and if you don't understand what a simple request with one of those tools can do to your schedule, you can really get yourself in trouble. And I saw, when I was a camera assistant, I saw that happening so many times, where a seemingly simple request just really, really put them in the mud schedule-wise.
Okay, one last question before Don gets on you, okay? I have, yeah. Because this is a pet peeve of so many people, okay, on our screenwriting forums, you know, and since you have a camera experience and you're a writer, how do you feel when in a script it says, the camera does this, or camera does that, I hate it.
To me, that's the screenwriting equivalent of watching a movie and seeing the sound boom dip into the shot. I see things, and I feel the same way about when people use the parenthetical beat. I hate seeing beat in a script, because to me that's the technique, and the technique should be invisible in a screenplay. Because a good screenplay should take the reader on a journey that is as close as words on a page can take you to the experience of sitting in the theater and watching the film unfold before your eyes. And I think that there are ways that you can use language that you can do the same thing. You can have the same effect, but without actually resorting to technical terms. For example, instead of writing close-up of a key unlocking a door, you could just say a well-manicured hand slides the key into a lock. Now, immediately, that's like when you're reading that, you know that that's a close-up shot. If you read in a script, a vast parking lot stretches away into the distance, well, that's probably a high and wide shot. In the same token, instead of writing beat in a script, I'll just do a single word action line, and I'll just write silence. Finally, you know, and then I'll hyphen it, and then the dialogue continues. Mm-hmm. And it hasn't broken the flow, but it's created the same dramatic effect. Like, it's still created a pause, and the time that it's taken you to read silence. And finally, you know, you've created a beat for the reader without drawing attention to the fact that you're using your little bag of screenwriting tricks. Does that make sense?
That's brilliant.
Yeah, no, it does.
That's brilliant, because actually what was going to be my question was is that I see that so often, you know, beat. And when I'm reading a script for pleasure, sometimes I find it useful, sometimes I find it intrusive. That's mm-hmm. that's a great technique for writers to use who are writing a screenplay, as opposed to, and a lot of amateurs write in their minds shooting scripts with the camera angles and all that, which yeah. drives me nuts. Because I personally read scripts for the story,
mm-hmm.
yeah. and I don't like reading scripts for camera direction. I like the story, and I don't like things that take me out of the story.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, when I write, I try to create as visceral experience as I can. So, like, I'll even write sound effects, you know, instead of just... I hate it when I read an action sequence in a script, and it reads like a blueprint, and it's boring, and it's cold, and it removes the reader from being involved in the experience. So, I'll use things like ellipses. I'll break up descriptive action lines and use the formatting to my advantage. You know, I'll like if it's a horror sequence, you know, he reaches out towards the door handle, slowly turning it, and then I'll suddenly in capitals on its own line, and then I'll skip to the next line. You know, the creature explodes through the wall, you know, things like that. Or, you know, if I'll say, you know, the police officer draws his gun, fires, and then I'll hyphenate it, and then just go bang, 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 bang. Instead of writing, he fires off three shots. I'll just write bang, 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 and it just makes it feel more live.
Yeah,
you know, it's just my thing. I mean, it's not everyone's cup of tea. Some people don't like seeing ellipses and sound effects and exclamation marks in a script. I'm all over that stuff.
Oh yeah. Well, actually, I was going to ask, you know, the whole bam, because, you know, my youngest son, you know, the fat kid, when he writes his stories, he puts those things in like bam, bam, bam.
Yeah.
And I always wonder if it's you know something that's acceptable or not.
I mean, it's a detail that I picked up from my writing partner that I worked with on Blood Rain. He's used to work in comic books. He still does a lot of storyboarding and stuff as well. Like, he's very, very talented visually. Like, he can draw anything. And yeah, he's a huge, huge fan of comic books, and that's where he got that. He took that from a different medium and brought that into his screenwriting. And when I read his stuff, I was just like, wow, your action stuff in particular has so much more life to it than mine. Like, my stuff just, it's kind of bland and boring on the page. And he was like, well, it's an action scene. It should be exciting to read, you know, and if it's a suspense scene, it should be scary, you know? And you know, that's where I picked that up from, and now I do that in all of my scripts. Like, you know, I change my writing depending on the tone of the scene. Like, it's amazing how many horror scripts I've read where there's no suspense, where they, you know, that they don't let, writers don't let scenes breathe. Like, if the scene on the screen is going to take 5 minutes for the character to walk from one end of the haunted school to the other, then it should take 5 minutes in the script. It should be 5 pages of suspense building us up to that moment. And a lot of horror scripts, screenplays fail on the page, and it takes a good director to bring life to them because the writer just kind of throws stuff out there. You know, they'll just have them opening the door, walking through, and then the creature appears. It's like, no, give us the tone. Like, take us on a journey here.
I mean, that's great. That's really great information. I think just completely makes the podcast because, you know, 80% of the folks who contribute to Simply Scripts are writing horror scripts. And that's great information for them. If we don't, anyone minds, I'd like to turn this a little bit. I'm really curious, to hear about The Legend of Silk Boy. And I'm kind of curious why, Neil, you're some kid from, you know, Vancouver, Canada, or wherever, and writing a script about a Chinese folklore. I mean, how did that happen?
Well, the producer David Louis, we'd worked with him before on another project that was also an animated film. Again, this was with the same writer, Chris Donaldson, who I worked with on Blood Rain. So the producer David, we'd done this other project for him. That project didn't happen. He had this other project that was based on, it was inspired by a true story. Like, the setup of the story, I guess, was inspired by true events. Basically, at the very, very first World Expo in, Victorian England, a guy from China won the gold and silver medals for his, presentation of silk. And this was a huge deal to people in China that the very first World Expo, it was a Chinaman that won these medals, and they were presented to him by Queen Victoria, and so the decision was made to do an animated film commemorating this, and the film would premiere as part of the Shanghai Expo that's currently going on right now in China. And the person that sort of pitched the initial story was the great-grandson of Zhu Rongkun, who was the guy that won these medals in London.
Oh, wow.
He's a descendant. So that was sort of the jumping-off point. And all we had coming into the project was that this guy won these medals, presented to him by Queen Victoria. We were told that the protagonist had to be a young boy that was kind of rebellious, and there had to be ginseng characters, mushroom characters, the flying Batgirl character. And that was pretty much all we had to go on. And we were told that we had free reign of the whole Shanghai Expo thing, like the mascot, the slogan from it, all of that stuff we could use because it's China. So there's no the Chinese government that's behind everything. So there was no copyright or trademark restrictions on all of this, all of these things that anywhere else in the world would be an issue in terms of branding and copywriting, etc.
So we
had a lot of free reign. Initially, it was really, really daunting because it's like, okay, how are we going to write a story about a guy that wins a medal from silk and this boy who comes from a family of silk makers? Like, silk making is not very dramatic and exciting. So what are we going to do with this? So the first thing we did was just research the hell out of the silk trade and the process of making silk. And we found out that there's this legend in China that silk was discovered by Princess Leizu, who was the daughter of the Yellow Emperor. She was sitting beneath the mulberry bush.
Yeah.
And a silk cocoon fell into her tea. And when she tried to take it out, it unraveled. And she was just amazed at this incredible... thin thread of silk, and that's how silk was discovered. So we're like, well, okay, that's kind of cool. So then we, in order to fit in these ginseng characters, we knew there had to be a fantastical world that existed alongside the real world. So we went the Wizard of Oz route, where we had a magical silk painting. And what happens is at the same time as Silk Boy's descendant winning the medals in Victorian London, there's a character called Lord Filthington, who was a British silk maker who was trying to use dirty old machines to make this nasty fabric. And he was very upset that he was defeated by this Chinese man. And so what happens is Lord Filthington IV, who's the descendant of the original Filthington, he steals the silk painting and tries to get revenge. And he goes into the silk painting and starts polluting and destroying this world inside this painting. And it's Silk Boy's fault that all this happens. So the kid goes into the painting to try and make up for his mistake. And along the way, he meets these characters. Silk Boy is a very selfish character. And along the way, he learns to be selfless. And then that's how we incorporated the silk thing. We have this, in Act 1, there's this moment where Silk Boy's grandfather explains to him that the reason silk is so special is because it's not about one thread. What makes silk so special is every thread working together.
I'm just curious. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And so we wrote the story. We had no idea what the Chinese would think of it. It took them a number of translations before they were able to understand our story.
You should have asked Todd to translate it.
What's that?
I'm sorry, Neil. I completely screwed up your story. My wife's Chinese. I study classical Chinese. I just, before this thing, I was beating Chinese characters into my eldest son's head. And my question was that, because it sounds like a fantastic story. When the great grandson of Xu Rongcun, kind of input did he have into the story? I mean, did he give you kind of an outline of a story that you took?
We never had any communication with him at all. We got a few notes from the producer saying, they were already in pre-production on it. Like they had like concepts and characters, and they were like, these are the characters that you have to have.
My God,
that was pretty much all we had. And so we had to find a story that these characters could exist within.
Oh,
and we just kind of leapt in at the deep end and hoped for the best, and it worked out really well. In fact, it couldn't have worked out better. Without realizing, the story of Princess Leizu is incredibly important to the Chinese. The way the producer explained it, he said that it would be like us writing a story about Jesus Christ.
I was thinking the same thing. I was like, how in the hell did you pull this off? And I would love to see it.
Okay, well, on that note, I mean, I would love to see that too. It sounds like a lot of fun from what I read about it. We're at the end of the show, but I did want to give Neil an opportunity to speak up on his newest production in which he's looking for something. So I'll let him talk about it for a moment before we go.
I've done a number of short films, and now I'm getting ready to take the big leap into directing my first feature film. And I've been working with a very talented writer by the name of Mitchell Politeski. And he's written a script called The Death of Alec Gray, and it's a time travel drama. We're looking for a production partner. We're looking for a producer to join us on this journey. It's a fantastic script. There's never been anything that I've wanted to make more than this film. It just speaks to me. It has all the elements that get me excited. Some fantastic characters. It's most it's one location for the first two thirds, and then it's got a small cast of 20 something. So there's some opportunities for some terrific up and coming actors to really put themselves on the map. And yeah, that's what we're up to.
Well, it sounds like a great opportunity for any producer listening. And
yeah, Michael, please, come on. You know, can you tell us a little bit, you said time, I'm sorry. Hey, I'll eat the bandwidth, okay? You said something about time travelers. Can you tell us a little bit more about the death of Alec Gray?
I mean, absolutely, I mean, yeah.
Like the summary or a plot line or something, because it sounds really exciting.
Yeah. Alec, the main character, he and his brother moved to a new city, having literally gotten away with a murder. And they move into this house, and in the basement of this house, they find this very small room. It's not much bigger than a closet, as a bare light bulb hanging from it. And they discover that this is a time room. But before Alec gets a chance to use it, his future self, burnt to a crisp, comes out of the time room and dies at his feet. And based on the watch on his future self's wrist, he's got less than 1 hour to figure out how he dies and to stop it.
Wow.
That sounds great. Man. Yeah.
You got to stop there. You got to stop there.
Yeah.
That is, I think if you get a producer, anybody who's listening to this is going to immediately run to see this movie.
It's definitely has that kind of memento kind of feel. Thematically, it's basically about it's free will versus determinism. It's an argument for, you know, do we have a choice in our life, or is everything set before us? And the main character is, that's the lesson that he must learn, or learn from not learning.
Thank you, Michael.
Sounds great. No worries. Okay, so thank you very much, Neil, for coming on and talking
thank
to us
for
a while.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
And I'm surprised that Pia was so quiet, but thank you, Pia, for coming by and being quiet for a change.
I feel like I got off lightly.
No, Don was here. So thank you, Don, too, for joining us. And thank you all for listening to Simply Radio. I'm sorry I called you Swedish, Pia. Don't be mad at me.
No, I am Swedish. You call me Swiss.
I called you
Jeez.
Swiss.
No, it's very annoying. I meet people and they say, oh, where are you from? And then I say, I'm Sweden. Oh, yeah, all the chocolates and banks. And I'm like, screw you. You know? Get your countries corrected, you know?